Chapter 51. When therefore a great Kabbalist wishes to tell you something, what he says will not be frivolous, vulgar, common, but rather a mystery, an oracle. Tommaso Garzoni, Il Teatro dei Vari e Diversi Cervelli Mondani. Venice, Zanfretti, 1583, Discorso 36. The illustrations I found in Milan and Paris weren't enough. Signor Garamond authorized me to spend a few days at the Deutsches Museum in Munich. I spent my evenings in the bars of Schwabing, or in the immense crypts, where elderly mustached gentlemen in lederhosen played music and lovers smiled at each other through a thick cloud of pork steam over full-liter beer steins. And in the afternoons I went through card catalogues of reproductions. Now and then I would leave the archive and stroll through the museum, where every human invention had been reconstructed. You push a button and dioramas of oil exploration came to life with working drills. You stepped inside a real submarine, you made the planets revolve, you played at producing acids and chain reactions. A less gothic conservatoire, totally of the future, peopled by unruly school groups being taught to idealize engineers. In the Deutsches Museum you also learned everything about mines. You went down a ladder and found yourself in a mine complete with tunnels, elevators for men and horses, narrow passages where scrawny, exploited children, made of wax, I hoped, were crawling. You went along endless dark corridors, you stopped at the edge of bottomless pits, you felt chilled to the bone, and you could almost catch a whiff of fire damp. Everything life-size. I was wandering in a tunnel, despairing of ever seeing the light of day again, when I came upon a man looking down over the railing, someone I seemed to recognize. The face was wrinkled and pale, the hair white, the look owlish. But the clothes were not right. I had seen that face before, above some uniform. It was like meeting, after many years, a priest now in civilian clothes, or a Capuchin without a beard. The man looked back at me, also hesitating. As usually happens in such situations, there was some fencing of furtive glances before he took the initiative and greeted me in Italian. Suddenly I could picture him in his usual dress. If he had been wearing a long yellow smock, he would have been Signor Salon. A. Salon, taxidermist. His laboratory was next door to my office on the corridor of the former factory building where I was the Marlowe of culture. I had encountered him at times on the stairs, and we had nodded to each other. "Strange," he said, holding out his hand. "We've been fellow tenants for so long, and we introduce ourselves in the bowels of the earth 1,000 miles away." We exchanged a few polite remarks. I got the impression that he knew exactly what I did, which was an achievement of sorts, since I wasn't sure myself. "How do you happen to be in a technological museum? I thought your publishing firm was concerned with more spiritual things." "How did you know that?" "Oh," he gestured vaguely, "people talk. I have many customers." "What sort of people go to a taxidermist?" "You are thinking, like everyone else, that it's not an ordinary profession. But I do not lack for customers, and I have all kinds. Museums, private collectors." "I don't often see stuffed animals in people's homes," I said. "No, it depends on the homes you visit. Or the cellars."
"Stuffed animals are kept in cellars?"
"Some people keep them in cellars.
Not all creches are in the light of the sun or the moon.
I'm suspicious of such customers, but you know how it is. A job is a job.
I'm suspicious of everything underground."
"Then why are you strolling in tunnels?"
"I'm checking. I distrust the underground world, but I want to understand it."
"There aren't many opportunities. The Roman catacombs, you'll say. Oh, no mystery there, too many tourists, and everything is under the control of the church. And then there are the sewers of Paris.
Have you been? They can be visited on Monday, Wednesday, and the last Saturday of every month.
But that's another tourist attraction.
Naturally, there are catacombs in Paris, too, and caves, not to mention the métro. Have you ever been to 145 Rue Lafayette?"
"I must confess I haven't."
"It's a bit out of the way, between Gare de l'Est and Gare du Nord. An unremarkable building at first sight. But if you look at it more closely, you realize that though the door looks wooden, it is actually painted iron, and the windows appear to belong to rooms unoccupied for centuries. People walk past and don't know the truth."
"What is the truth?"
"That the house is fake. It's a facade, an enclosure with no room, no interior. It's really a chimney, a ventilation flue that serves to release the vapors of the regional métro. And once you know this, you feel you are standing at the mouth of the underworld. If you could penetrate those walls, you could have access to subterranean Paris. I have had occasion to spend hours and hours in front of that door that conceals the door of doors, the point of departure for the journey to the center of the earth. Why do you think they made it?
To ventilate the metro, as you said.
A few ducts would have been enough for that. No, when I see those subterranean passages, my suspicions are aroused. Do you know why?
As he spoke of darkness, he seemed to give off light. I asked him why his suspicions were aroused.
Because if the masters of the world exist, they can only be underground. This is a truth that all sense but few dare utter. Perhaps the only man bold enough to say it in print was Saint-Yves d'Alvedre. Do you know him?
I may have heard the name mentioned by one of our diabolicals, but I wasn't sure.
He is the one who told us about Agartha, the underground headquarters of the King of the World, the occult center of the Synarchy,
the taxidermist said.
He had no fear. He felt sure of himself. But all those who spoke out after him were eliminated because they knew too much.
As we walked along the tunnel, Signor Salon cast nervous glances at the mouths of new passageways, as if in those shadows he was seeking confirmation of his suspicions.
Have you ever wondered why in the last century all the great metropolises hastened to build subways?
To solve traffic problems?
Before there were automobiles, when there were only horse-drawn carriages. From a man of your intelligence, I would have expected a more perceptive explanation.
You have one?
Perhaps,
Signor Salon said, and he looked pensive, absent. The conversation died. Then he said that he had to be running along. But after shaking my hand, he lingered another few seconds, as if struck by a thought.
Apropos that colonel, what was his name? The one who came to Garamond some time ago to talk to you about a Templar treasure. Have you had any news of him?
It was like a slap in the face, this brutal and indiscreet display of knowledge about something I considered private and buried. I wanted to ask him how he knew, but I was afraid. I confined myself to saying in an indifferent tone, "Oh, that old story. I'd forgotten all about it. But apropos, why did you say apropos?"
"Did I say that? Ah, yes, well, it seemed to me he had discovered something underground."
"How do you know?"
"I really can't say. I can't remember who spoke to me about it. A customer, perhaps. But my curiosity is always aroused when the underground world is involved. The little manias of old age. Good evening."
He went off, and I stood there to ponder the meaning of this encounter. Chapter 52. In certain regions of the Himalayas, among the 22 temples that represent the 22 arcana of Hermes and the 22 letters of some sacred alphabets, Agartha forms the mystic zero which cannot be found. A colossal chessboard that extends beneath the earth through almost all the regions of the globe. Saint-Yves d'Alvedre, Mission de l'Inde en Europe. Paris, Calman Lévy, 1886, pages 54 and 65. When I got back, I told the story to Belbo and Diotalevi, and we ventured various hypotheses. Perhaps Salon, a gossiping eccentric who dabbled in mysteries, had happened to meet Ardenti, and that was the whole story, unless Salon knew something about Ardenti's disappearance and was working for the ones who had caused him to disappear. Another hypothesis, Salon was a police informer. Then, as our diabolicals came and went, the memory of Salon faded and was lost among his similars. One day, Allier came to the office to report on some manuscripts Belbo had sent him. His opinions were precise, severe, comprehensive. Allier was clever. It didn't take him long to figure out the Garamond minutious double game, and we now talked openly in front of him. He understood. He would destroy a text with a few sharp observations, then remark with smooth cynicism that it would be fine for minutius. I asked him what he could tell me about Agartha and Saint-Yves d'Alvedre.
"Saint-Yves d'Alvedre," he said. "A bizarre man, beyond doubt. From his youth he spent time with the followers of Fabre d'Olivet. He became a humble clerk in the Ministry of the Interior, but ambitious. We naturally took a dim view of his marriage to Marie Victoire."
Allier couldn't resist shifting to the first person as if he were reminiscing. "Who was Marie Victoire? I love gossip," Belbo said.
"Marie Victoire de Riesnitch. Very beautiful when she was the intimate of the Empress Eugénie. But by the time she met Saint-Yves, she was over 50, and he was in his early 30s. For her, a mésalliance, of course. What's more, to give him a title, she bought some property, I can't remember where, that had belonged to a certain Marquis d'Alvedre. So, while our unscrupulous character boasted of his title, in Paris they sang songs about the gigolo. Since he could now live off his income, he devoted himself to his dream, which was to find a political formula that would lead to a harmonious society. Synarchy, as opposed to anarchy. A European society governed by three councils, representing economic power, judicial power, and spiritual power. The church and the scientists, in other words. An enlightened oligarchy that would eliminate class conflicts. We've heard worse. What about Agartha? Santiv claimed to have been visited one day by a mysterious Afghan, a man named Haji Sharif, who can't have been an Afghan because the name is clearly Albanian. This man revealed to him the secret dwelling place of the king of the world, though Santiv himself never used that expression. He called it Agartha, the place that cannot be found. Where did he write this? In his Mission de l'Inde en Europe, a work that, incidentally, has influenced a great deal of contemporary political thought. In Agartha there are underground cities, and below them, closer to the center, live the 5,000 sages that govern it. The number 5,000 suggests, of course, the hermetic roots of the Vedic language, as you gentlemen know. And each root is a magic hierogram connected to a celestial power and sanctioned by an infernal power. The central dome of Agartha is lighted from above by something like mirrors, which allow the light from the planet's surface to arrive only through the enharmonic spectrum of colors, as opposed to the solar spectrum of our physics books, which is merely diatonic. The wise ones of Agartha study all holy languages in order to arrive at the universal language, which is Vatthan. When they come upon mysteries too profound, they levitate, and would crack their skulls against the vault of the dome if their brothers did not restrain them. They forge the lightning bolts, they guide the cyclic currents of the interpolar and intertropical fluids, the interferential extensions in the different zones of the Earth's latitude and longitude. They select species and have created small animals with extraordinary psychic powers, animals which have a tortoise shell with a yellow cross, a single eye, and a mouth at either end, and polypod animals which can move in all directions. Agartha is probably where the Templars found refuge after their dispersion, and where they perform custodial duties. Anything else? But was he serious? I asked. I believe he was. At first we considered him a fanatic, but then we realized that he was referring, perhaps in a visionary figurative way, to an occult direction of history. Isn't it said that history is a blood-stained and senseless riddle? No, impossible. There must be a design. There must be a mind. That is why over the centuries men far from ignorant have thought of the masters or the king of the world not as physical beings, but as a collective symbol, as the successive temporary incarnation of a fixed intention, an intention with which the great priestly orders and the vanished chivalries were in touch. Do you believe this? Belbo asked. Persons more balanced than Dalvedra seek the unknown superiors. And do they find them? Allier laughed as if to himself. What sort of unknown superiors would they be if they allowed the first person who comes along to know them? Gentlemen, we have work to do. There is one more manuscript here, and what a coincidence, it's a treatise on secret societies. Any good? Belbo asked. Perish the thought. But it could do for Minucius. Chapter 53. Unable to control destinies on Earth openly because governments would resist, this mystic alliance can act only through secret societies. These, gradually created as the need for them arises, are divided into distinct groups. Groups seemingly in opposition, sometimes advocating the most contradictory policies in religion, politics, economics, and literature. But they are all connected, all directed by the invisible center that hides its power as it thus seeks to move all the scepters of the Earth. J. M. Hernevransky, quoted by P. Sidir, Histoire et Doctrine des Rose-Croix, Bibliothèque des Hermétistes, Paris, 1910. One day I saw Signor Salon at the door of his laboratory. Suddenly, for no reason, I expected him to hoot like an owl. He greeted me as if I were an old friend, and asked how things were going at work. I made a noncommittal gesture, smiled at him, and hurried on. I was struck again by the thought of Agartha. Santiv's ideas, as Allier had explained them, might be fascinating to a diabolical, but certainly not alarming. And yet in Salon's words and in his face, when we met in Munich, there had been alarm. So as I went out, I decided to drop in at the library and look for La Mission de l'Inde en Europe. There was the usual mob in the catalogue room and at the call desk. With some shoving, I got hold of the drawer I needed, found the call number, filled out a slip, and handed it to the clerk. He informed me that the book had been checked out, and as usual in libraries, he seemed to enjoy giving me this news. But at that very moment, a voice behind me said, "Actually, it is available. I just returned it." I looked around and saw Inspector De Angelis. And he recognized me, too quickly, I thought, since I had seen him in circumstances that were, for me, exceptional, whereas he had met me in the course of a routine inquiry. Also, in the Ardenti days, I had had a wispy beard and longer hair. What a sharp eye! Had he been keeping me under surveillance since my return to Italy, or was he simply good at faces? Policemen had to master the science of observation, memorize features, names. "Signor Casaubon, we're reading the same books." I held out my hand. "It's Dr. Casaubon now, has been for a while. Maybe I'll take the police entrance exam as you advised me that morning. Then I'll be able to get the books first." "All you have to do is be here first," he said. "But the book's returned now, and you can collect it. Let me buy you a coffee meanwhile." The invitation made me uncomfortable, but I couldn't say no. We sat in a neighborhood cafe. He asked me how I happened to be interested in the mission of India, and I was tempted to ask him how he happened to be interested in it. But I decided first to deflect his suspicion. I told him that in my spare time I was continuing my study of the Templars. According to Eschenbach, the Templars left Europe and went to India, some believe to the kingdom of Agartha. Now it was his turn. "But tell me," I asked, "why did you take out the book?" "Oh, you know how these things go," he replied. "Ever since you suggested that book on the Templars to me, I've been reading up on the subject. I don't have to tell you that after the Templars, the next logical step is Agartha." Touché. Then he said, "I was joking. I took out the book because..." He hesitated. "The fact is, when I'm off duty, I like to browse in libraries. It keeps me from turning into a robot, a mechanical cop. You could probably express the idea more elegantly. But tell me about yourself." I gave a performance, an autobiographical summary down to the wonderful adventure of metals. He asked me, "In that publishing firm, and in the one next door, aren't you doing books on the occult sciences?" How did he know about Minucius? From information gathered years before, when he was keeping an eye on Belbo? Or was he still on the Ardenti case? "With characters like Colonel Ardenti turning up constantly at Garamond, and with Minucius there to handle them," I said, "Signor Garamond decided that was rich soil, worth tilling. If you look for such types, you can find them by the carload." "But Ardenti disappeared. I hope the others don't." "They haven't yet, though I almost wish they would. However, satisfy my curiosity, Inspector. I imagine in your job people disappear, or worse, every day. Do you devote so much time to all of them?" He looked at me with amusement. "What makes you think I'm still devoting time to Colonel Ardenti?" All right, he was gambling, had raised the ante, and it was up to me now to call his bluff if I had the courage to make him show his cards. What was there to lose? "Come, Inspector," I said, "you know everything about Garamond and Minucius, and you were looking for a book on Agartha." "You mean Ardenti spoke to you about Agartha?" Touché again. "Yes, Ardenti had spoken to us about Agartha, too, as far as I could remember." But I parried, "No, only about the Templars." "I see," he said. Then he added, "You mustn't think we follow a case until it's solved. That only happens on television. Being a cop is like being a dentist. A patient comes in, you give him a little of the old drill, prescribe something, he comes back in 2 weeks, and in the meantime you deal with 100 other patients. A case like the Colonel's can remain in the active file maybe for 10 years, and then, while you're in the middle of a different case, taking some confession, there's a hint, a clue, and wham! A short circuit in the brain, you get an idea. Or else you don't, and that's it." "And what did you find recently that brought on a short circuit?" "An indiscreet question, don't you think? But there are no mysteries, believe me. The Colonel came up again by chance. We were keeping an eye on a character, for quite different reasons, and found he was spending time at the Picatrix Club. You've heard of it?" "Oh, I know the magazine, not the club. What goes on there?" "Nothing. Nothing at all. People a bit loony, maybe, but well-behaved." "Then I remembered that Ardenti used to go there. A cop's talent consists entirely of remembering things, a name, a face, even after 10 years have gone by. And so I began wondering what was happening at Garamond, that's all." "What does the Picatrix Club have to do with your political squad?" "Perhaps it's the impertinence of a clear conscience, but you seem tremendously curious." "Oh, you're the one who invited me for coffee." "True, and both of us are off duty." "See here, if you look at the world in a certain way, everything is connected to everything else. A nice hermetic philosophy, I thought. He immediately added, I'm not saying that those people are connected with politics, but there was a time when we went looking for the red brigades in squats and the black brigades in martial arts clubs. Nowadays, the opposite could be true. We live in a strange world. My job, I assure you, was easier 10 years ago. Today, even among ideologies, there's no consistency. There are times when I think of switching to narcotics. There, at least you can rely on a heroin pusher to push heroin. There was a pause. He was hesitating, I think. Then from his pocket he produced a notebook the size of a missile. Look, Kasabin, you see some strange people as part of your job. You go to the library and you look up even stranger books. Help me. What do you know about Synarchy? Now you're embarrassing me. Almost nothing. I heard it mentioned in connection with Saint-Yves, that's all. What are they saying about it around? Well, if they're saying anything I haven't heard, to be frank, it sounds like fascism to me. Actually, many of its theses were picked up by Action Française. If that were the whole story, I'd be okay. I find a group that talks about Synarchy, and I can give it a political color. But in my reading, I've learned that in 1929, a certain Vivien Postel-Dumas and Jean Canudo founded a group called Polaris, which was inspired by the myth of the King of the World. They proposed a synarchic project, social service opposed to capitalist profit, the elimination of the class struggle through cooperatives. It sounds like a kind of Fabian socialism, a libertarian and communitarian movement. Note that both Polaris and the Irish Fabians were accused of being involved in a synarchic plot led by the Jews. And who accused them? The Revue Internationale des Sociétés Secrètes, which talks about a Jewish Masonic Bolshevik plot. Many of its contributors belong to a secret right-wing organization called La Sapinière. And they say that all these revolutionary groups are only the front for a diabolical plot hatched by an occultist cénacle. Now you'll say, all right, Saint-Yves ended up inspiring reformist groups, but these days the right lumps everything together and sees it all as a demo-Pluto-social-Judaic conspiracy. Mussolini did the same thing. But why accuse them of being controlled by an occultist cénacle? According to the little I know, take Picatrix, for example, those occultism people couldn't care less about the workers' movement. So it seems also to me, O Socrates. So? Thanks for the Socrates. But now we're coming to the good part. The more I read on the subject, the more I get confused. In the 40s, various self-styled synarchic groups sprang up. They talked about a new European order led by a government of wise men, above party lines. And where did these groups meet? In Vichy collaborationist circles. Then you say we've got it wrong. Synarchy is right-wing. But hold on. Having read this far, I begin to see that there is one theme that finds them all in agreement. Synarchy exists and secretly rules the world. But here comes the but. But. On January 24th, 1937, Dmitry Navashin, Mason and Martinist, I don't know what Martinist means, but I think it's one of those sects, economic advisor of the Front Populaire, after having been director of a Moscow bank, was assassinated by the Organisation Secrète d'Action Révolutionnaire et Nationale, better known as La Cagoule, financed by Mussolini. It was said then that La Cagoule was guided by a secret synarchy, and that Navashin was killed because he had discovered its mysteries. A document originating from left-wing circles during the occupation denounced the synarchic Pact of the Empire, which was responsible for the French defeat, a pact that was a manifestation of Portuguese-style fascism. But then it turned out that the pact was drawn up by Dumas and Canudo and contained ideas that they had published and publicized everywhere. Nothing secret about it. But these ideas were revealed as secret, extremely secret, in 1946 by one Husson, who denounced a revolutionary synarchic pact of the left, as he wrote in his Synarchie, Panorama de 25 années d'activité occulte, which he signed, wait, let me find it, Geoffroy de Charnay. Fine, I said, Charnay was a companion of Molay, the Grand Master of the Templars. They died together at the stake. Here we have a neo-Templar attacking Synarchy from the right. But Synarchy is born at Agartha, which is the refuge of the Templars. What did I tell you? You see, you've given me an additional clue. Unfortunately, it only increases the confusion. So on the right, a synarchic pact of the left is denounced as socialist and secret, though it's really not secret. It's the same synarchic pact, as you saw, that was denounced by the left. And now we come to new revelations. Synarchy is a Jesuit plot to undermine the Third Republic, a thesis expounded by Roger Monvais, leftist. To allow me to sleep nights, my reading then tells me that in 1943 certain Vichy military circles, Pétainist, yes, but anti-German, documents circulated that prove Synarchy was a Nazi plot. Hitler was a Rosicrucian influenced by the Masons, who now have moved from hatching a Judeo-Bolshevik plot to making an Imperial German one. So everything is settled. If only that were all. Yet another revelation. Synarchy is a plot of the international technocrats. This was asserted in 1960 by one Vieux-Marais, Le 14e complot du 13 mai. The techno-synarchic plot wants to destabilize governments, and to do it provokes wars, backs coup d'état, foments schisms in political parties, promotes internecine hatreds. Do you recognize these synarchists? My God, it's the IMS, the imperialist multinational state, what the Red Brigades were talking about a few years ago. The answer is correct. And now, what does Inspector De Angelis do if he finds a reference to synarchy somewhere? He asks the advice of Dr. Kasaban, the Templar expert. My answer? There exists a secret society with branches throughout the world, and its plot is to spread the rumor that a universal plot exists. Oh, you're joking, but I... No, I'm not joking. Come and read the manuscripts that turn up at Minutius. But if you want a more down-to-earth explanation, it's like the story of the man with a bad stammer who complains that the radio station won't hire him as an announcer because he didn't carry a party card. We always have to blame our failures on somebody else, and dictatorships always need an external enemy to bind their followers together. As the man said, for every complex problem there's a simple solution, and it's wrong. And if on a train I find a bomb wrapped in a flyer that talks about synarchy, is it enough for me to say that this is a simple solution to a complex problem? Why, have you found bombs on trains that... No, excuse me, that's really not my business. But why did you say that to me, then? Because I was hoping you'd know more than I do. Because perhaps I'm relieved to see you can't make head or tail of it either. You say you have to read lunatics by the carload and you consider it a waste of time. I don't. For me, the works of your lunatics, by your, I'm referring to you normal people, are important texts. What a lunatic writes may explain the thinking of the man who puts the bomb on the train. Or are you afraid of becoming a police informer? No, not at all. Besides, looking for things in card catalogs is my business. If the right piece of information turns up, I'll keep you in mind. As he rose from his chair, De Angelis dropped the last question. Among your manuscripts, have you ever found any reference to the Trey? What's that? I don't know. An organization, maybe? I don't even know if it exists. I've heard it mentioned, and it occurred to me in connection with your lunatics. Say hello to your friend Belbo for me. Tell him I'm not keeping tabs on any of you. The fact is, I have a dirty job, and my misfortune is that I enjoy it. As I went home, I asked myself who had come out ahead. He had told me a number of things. I'd told him nothing. If I wanted to be suspicious, I could think perhaps that he had got something out of me without my being aware of it. But if you're too suspicious, you fall into the psychosis of synarchic plots. When I told Leah about the episode, she said, "If you ask me, he was sincere. He really did want to get it all off his chest. You think he can find anyone at police headquarters who will listen to him wonder whether Jean Canudo was right-wing or left? He only wanted to find out if it's his fault he can't understand it, or if the whole thing is too difficult. And you weren't able to give him the one true answer." "The one true answer?" "Of course, but there's nothing to understand. Synarchy is God." "God?" "Yes, mankind can't endure the thought that the world was born by chance, by mistake, just because four brainless atoms bumped into one another on a slippery highway. So a cosmic plot has to be found. God, angels, devils. Synarchy performs the same function on a lesser scale." "Then I should have told him that people put bombs on trains because they're looking for God." "Why not?"
Chapter 54. The Prince of Darkness is a Gentleman. Shakespeare, King Lear, Act 3, Scene 4. It was autumn. One morning I went to Via Marchese Gualdi, because I had to get Signor Garamond's authorization to order some color photographs from abroad. I glimpsed Allier in Signora Grazia's office, bent over the file of minutious authors, but I didn't disturb him because I was late for my meeting. When our business was over, I asked Signor Garamond what Allier was doing in the secretary's office. "The man's a genius," Garamond said.
An extraordinary mind, keen, learned. The other evening I took him to dinner with some of our authors, and he made me look great. What conversation, what style! A gentleman of the old school, an aristocrat. They've thrown away the mold. What knowledge, what culture! No, more, what information! He told delightful anecdotes about characters of a century ago, and I swear it was as if he had known them personally. Do you want to hear the idea he gave me as we were going home? He said we shouldn't just sit and wait for Isis-unveiled authors to turn up on their own. It's a waste of time and effort to read when you don't even know whether the authors are willing to underwrite the expenses. Instead, we have a gold mine at our disposal, the list of all the minutious authors of the last 20 years. You understand? We write to our old, glorious authors, or at least the ones who bought up their remainders, and we say to them, "Dear sir, are you aware that we have inaugurated a series of works of erudition, tradition, and the highest spirituality? Would you, as an author of distinction and refinement, be interested in venturing into this terra incognita, etc., etc.? A genius, I tell you. I believe he wants us all to join him Sunday evening, plans to take us to a castle, a fortress, no more, a villa in the Turin area. It seems that extraordinary things are to happen there, a rite, a Sabbath, where someone will make gold or quicksilver. It's a whole world to be discovered, my dear Kasaubin, even if, as you know, I have the greatest respect for science, the science to which you are devoting yourself with such passion. Indeed, I am very, very pleased with your work, and, yes, there's that little financial adjustment you mentioned. I haven't forgotten it, and in due course we'll talk about it. Allier told me the lady will also be there, the beautiful lady, or perhaps not beautiful, but attractive. There's something about her eyes. That friend of Belbo's, what's her name?
Lorenza Pellegrini.
Yes. There's something, no, between her and our Belbo.
I believe they're good friends.
Ah, a gentleman's answer. Bravo, Kasaubin. But I do not inquire out of idle curiosity. The fact is that I feel like a father to all of you, and glissons à la guerre comme à la guerre. Goodbye, dear boy.
We really did have an appointment with Allier in the hills near Turin, Belbo told me. A double appointment. The early hours of the evening would be a party in the castle of a very well-to-do Rosicrucian. Then Allier would take us a few kilometers away to a place where, at midnight, naturally, some kind of druidic rite, Belbo wasn't sure what, would be held.
I was also thinking, Belbo added, that we should sit down somewhere and give some thought to our history of metals, because here we keep being interrupted. Why don't we leave Saturday and spend a couple of days in my old house in... name omitted. It's a beautiful spot, you'll see. The hills are worth it. Diotelevia's coming, and maybe Lorenza will, too. Of course, you can bring along anyone you want. He didn't know Leah, but he knew I had a companion. I said I'd come alone. Leah and I had quarreled 2 days before. Nothing serious, it would be forgotten in a few days, but meanwhile I wanted to get away from Milan. So we all went to, name omitted, the Garamond Trio and Lorenza Pellegrini. At our departure, a tense moment, when it came time to get into the car, Lorenza said, "Maybe I'll stay behind so you three can work in peace. I'll join you later with Simon." Belbo, both hands on the wheel, locked his elbows, stared straight ahead and said in a low voice, "Get in." Lorenza got in, and all through the trip, sitting up front, she kept her hand on the back of Belbo's neck as he drove in silence. Name omitted, was still the town Belbo had known during the war. But new houses were few, he told us. Agriculture was in decline, because the young people had migrated to the city. He pointed to hills, now pasture, that had once been yellow with grain. The town appeared suddenly, after a curve at the foot of the low hill where Belbo's house was. We got a view beyond it of the Monferrato plain, covered with a light luminous mist. As the car climbed, Belbo directed our attention to the hill opposite, almost completely bare. At the top of it, a chapel flanked by two pines. "It's called the Brico," he said, then added, "It doesn't matter if it has no effect on you. We used to go there for the angels' lunch on Easter Monday. Now you can reach it in the car in 5 minutes, but then we went on foot, and it was a pilgrimage."